Well, I was excited because Telsey was talkative tonight. I was looking forward to getting to hear her talk. I guess you guys got to take up the slack since she's gone now. Y'all should be talkative tonight as well. All right. We have our devotional sign up for Wednesday nights here, and all the slots but one are filled. It's the coveted 5-minute message on March 27th. So, gentlemen, if you feel compelled to speak and have a thought on your heart and mind, I'm going to start it here. All right. Sorry, guys. There you go. Mr. Harris has that. So it's going to be a Harris night that night. Brody's got the songs. Joshua has the message. And Gabe has the prayer. So it's the Harris hour. I love that. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Wealth. We're going to talk about wealth tonight. How do you measure wealth? Okay. I'm not sure. Okay, we have to work on that a little bit. So wealth rhymes with health. So where are we going with that, Jim? All right, so your wealth is measured in health. All right, you guys talk amongst yourself for just a minute. I'm going to go get the clicker. I'll be right back. I had to turn the microphone off so y'all wouldn't hear me panting back and forth. So health, tell me another way to measure wealth. Net worth, all right. So if the stock market's up and the 401k is doing well and the job off and the job list is full, then the net worth is pretty good. Okay, so net worth as in dollars, as in money. One more. Stuff. Yeah. The golden rule, he who dies with the most gold wins. Family, all right, another great way to measure wealth. So tonight we're in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul is writing to Timothy, this young minister who's serving in the church, the congregation in Ephesus. What do we know about either the church in Ephesus or the Ephesian community itself and their relationship with wealth? Does the Bible give us any hint as to what the community's relationship with wealth is or the church's relationship with wealth? And again, I cheat because I knew the answer was coming up, so I had a chance to look at it. So it's not that I'm smarter than anybody else. I just had the cheat sheet. All right, so we're in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Put your finger there, keep it, we'll come back. Let's go to Acts chapter 19. This will probably sound familiar when we get there. Acts chapter 19. We're going to start in verse 23. About that time, there arose a great disturbance about the way. A silversmith named Demetrius, who had silver shrines of Artemis, brought in no little business for the craftsmen. He called them together along with the craftsmen, along with the workmen in related trades, and said, "Men, you know we receive a good income from this business, and you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus, and in particularly the whole province of Asia, and practically the whole. He says that man-made gods are no gods at all. There is danger not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited, and the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty." When they heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Soon the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and rushed as one man into the theater. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, But the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. The Jews pushed Alexander to the front, and some of the crowd shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make defense before the people. But when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." This is Paul and his mission trip to Ephesus. So what's their relationship with wealth? The communities. But we know at least what relationship a few of them is, right? We know how a few of them relate to wealth. We have this artisan here who is frustrated because he's afraid that that Paul's teaching is going to cut into his profits, right? He is Demetrius. He's frustrated because after all he makes little shrines for Artemis, Diana, the fertility goddess in Ephesus. And Ephesus prided themselves on being the keeper of the great temple for Artemis, and it was a tourist attraction. It was a great big attraction. It brought in some money for them, and so the community in Ephesus, at least some of them, had a very worldly, very materialistic relationship with wealth. And if you notice in that statement, it says almost the whole city turns out, and they have a riot. They go to the town hall, they go to the gathering center, and they're shouting, "Great is Artemis of Ephesus." They want to make sure that their prideful standing as the keeper of the temple for Artemis isn't diminished, or that the Artemis herself is not diminished, and that their income from Artemis is not diminished. So there's a problem with an unhealthy relationship with money and an unhealthy view of wealth. If they had a view of wealth as health or as family or as a relationship with their kids or just general well-being, it might be different, but they don't. They have a relationship of greed. And so Paul is going to write to Timothy and speak to Timothy in chapter 6 of 1 Timothy about greed, about preaching and teaching on greed, about dealing with greed. And the problem he speaks of beginning in verse 3 is that greed can destroy faith. So obviously not only is an unhealthy relationship with money and wealth a problem in the community, it's clearly a problem in the church because Timothy deals with that. Let's read 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 3. It won't be on the screen, so open your Bibles and read with me. I'm reading out of the old NIV, but we'll start in verse 3. 1 Timothy 6:3. "If anyone teaches false doctrines and does not agree with sound instruction of our Lord Jesus Christ and to godly teaching, he is conceited and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy interest in controversies and quarrels about words that result in envy, strife, malicious talk, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of corrupt mind who have been robbed of the truth and who think that godliness is a means to financial gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that." Let's stop here. So there were false teachers in the city of Ephesus. We know that from the get-go. And they were false teachers back when Paul was there in his missionary journey. There are still false teachers there when he's writing to Timothy. And in the opening verses of this very letter, Paul gives Timothy some instructions about dealing with those. It won't be on the screen, but in chapter 1, verse 3 and 4, 1 Timothy 1, 3 and 4, he says, Paul writes to Timothy, he says, "I urge you when I went to Macedonia, stay there in Ephesus so that you may command certain men not to teach false doctrines, different doctrines, other doctrines. They might teach them any longer, nor to devote themselves to myths, fables, and endless genealogies. These promote controversies rather than God's work. They are speculations, they're questions, and they get in the way of edifying and stewardship, which he says is by faith." So one of the assignments that Paul has for Timothy is you need to go to, part of your job there in Ephesus is to straighten out the false teachers, to correct the false teachers, false teaching. And if you just kind of do a little scan through 1 Timothy, there Paul gives some very complimentary descriptions of the false teachers there. In chapter 1, verse 3, and chapter 6, verse 3, they were teaching false doctrines. In chapter 1, verse 7, they wanted to teach Old Testament law. So evidently they were trying to make Christians Jews first and then Christians second, or come to Christ through Judaism. In chapter 1, verse 4, and chapter 4, verse 7, they constructed ridiculous stories based on obscure genealogical details. They had these fables, these histories. In chapter 1, verse 7, and 6, verse 4, they were conceited. They were argumentative, 1, 4, 6, 4. They were fond of meaningless talk, chapter 1, verse 6. They didn't even know what they were talking about, he says in chapter 1, verse 7, and chapter 6, verse 4. So there was a problem with false teachers, a problem with false teachers in Ephesus. And now we learn, the latter part of verse 5, that these false teachers were motivated by greed. They think that godliness is a means of financial gain. Well, I don't know about you, but I got into preaching for the money. And evidently they were doing the same thing. How in the world do I need some advice here, because it hasn't panned out. I'm being paid very generously. And I told them when I started I had to make more than I was worth. So they've seen to that from the get-go. But how do I get rich? You guys coach me. In all honesty, what would a person in the first century Ephesus see about preaching that they thinks is a means to wealth? How are you going to get rich preaching in Ephesus? Or anybody else for that matter? Depends on what you preach. Okay. I thought that might be where Jim was going with the health and wealth gospel there for a minute when he was saying it was talking about wealth with his health. So maybe a health and wealth gospel? There's some preachers today that the more you give me, the more God's going to bless you, right? So maybe a message like that. Okay, what else? Fame. Okay. You become the big church preacher and you get to be popular. And, yeah, earthly wealth and fame. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So a certain amount of fame, a certain amount of recognition. Yeah, okay. What else? I'm taking notes. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 7, Paul is in a, this is a little, I love Paul. I read this as sarcasm, and I think Paul's allowed that, but he's basically apologizing for preaching for free. He said, "You know, I'm sorry. I didn't think enough to charge you for my preaching." And so the thought seems to be in 2 Corinthians 11. Is it 2? Yeah, 2 Corinthians 11, 7, that there was kind of a mentality, at least among some, and clearly some in the church in Corinth, where if your preaching's free, then that's probably you charge for your preaching based on what you believe your preaching is worth. So if you're not charging anything, that tells us how much you value your preaching, how much your preaching is worth. And so Paul kind of sarcastically says, "Man, I'm sorry I didn't charge you for that." And so if that's a mentality in that part of in the world at that moment, then you know, you get a guy who charges some exorbitant fees for speaking, then clearly he must have a really, really, really valuable message. So that may be one way in which they were seeing preaching as a means of godly of financial gain. Luke chapter 20 talks about the scribes devouring the widows' houses, and so the idea would be they would prey on maybe someone would prey on a widow and move into her house and then slowly take over her assets because he's manipulating her. Whatever it was, they saw that there was some prophet, who was it, Simon the sorcerer in Acts, where he saw them laying on of hands and he kind of wanted to buy a franchise into that because he could see some money in that. So they saw this as a means of financial gain. And so this was a business to them. It wasn't a ministry, it was a business. Yes, sir. Right. Charging people to come in Okay, all right. So we could have a concert. We could have some. We'd have a concert. We could have some high-end speakers come in, charge some nice ticket prices, and yeah, okay. All right, yeah. All these kind of ideas about there's this may be a road to some financial gain, but if you look at verse 5, it says that their material outlook on life has cost them their faith. Paul says that these men have been robbed of the truth. Some translations say deprived of the truth or destitute of the truth. The language there suggests that this was something, the truth was something they had at one time, and then they've lost it. They were robbed of it. They were deprived of it. Now, I don't know that I want to get, that's not the hill I want to die on. I'm welcome to be wrong on that. There's a couple of thought translations that kind of convey that same thought as well. The Message says, the truth is but a distant memory for these people who think that this is a means for financial gain. So they must have had the truth at some point, but then they shifted the focus from proclaiming the truth to profiting from the truth. And so now the Message says that's a distant memory. The New Living Translation says they've turned their backs on the truth. So they may have at one time possessed the truth. They may have really been people who proclaimed the message of God in an honest and truthful fashion. But because their focus shifted from that as a priority to making money as a priority, the truth has been lost to them. Now, verse 6 goes on to say there is great gain in godliness, but it's not necessarily financial gain. There's great gain in godliness. Verse 6 talks about believers finding contentment in godliness, and that is great gain. Contentment. So here's a question, and no churchy answers. If you're going to give a churchy answer, just don't answer. How much more do you need to be content? How close are you to being content? Is there a whole lot more you need to find contentment, or are you just a little over the next nudge? I remember when Janet and I first married, we just celebrated our 45th anniversary, and I remember there was a couple that we graduated high school with, and he was making $800 a month. I thought, man, if I could ever make 800 bucks a month, I would be on easy street. I'm not sure I think that way anymore, but I did think that way at one time. So for me, at that point in my life, 800 bucks a month was contentment. How close are you? What do you need? Don't give me a churchy answer, Jim. What do you need to achieve that level? Ah, okay, all right. Now, you know what I mean by churchy answer. What I mean is don't tell me what you think I want to hear or what we're expected to say. If you can give an honest answer and say, I'm totally content right this minute, then give me an honest answer. But don't, you know, sometimes you're talking with somebody and they know what they're supposed to say, and so they throw that out there, whether there's any value in that or not. That's what I'm talking about, a churchy answer. So, yeah, once you begin to understand the value of things, what's valuable and what's not, then you can find contentment. Anybody else? Good non-churchy answer. I'm sorry? You agree with him? All right. All in favor of Jim, say aye. All right. Verse 7. Material gain is irrelevant and greed is irrational because we brought nothing into this world and we can take nothing out of it. My stepfather was in the funeral business, and he used to say, I've seen those caskets, they don't have pockets in them. So you can't take that with you. Chapter 4, verse 8, godliness has value. It's profitable for all things, holding promise for both the present life and the life to come. Now, how many of you can honestly say you're content where you're at? Great. The Bible, Paul gives Timothy in verse 8, I think it is. Yep. his definition of what you need to be content. What is it? Food and clothes. Now, I won't answer for you, but I can answer for me. If God tonight took everything away from me except food and clothes, I might struggle with contentment. So I'm not the only one. Yeah. But what he's, am I reading him right? Verse 8. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. So we just need a little editing right there. Instead of the declarative will be, we'll have the presumptive should be. You know, we'd like to be, we ought to be. I think that gives us kind of a view of the Holy Spirit inspired us, what God views as necessities. Which I was pretty sure he'd see my motorcycle as a necessity, but evidently he doesn't. Food and clothes. We have food and clothes. We ought to be content with that. If that's the measure of needs and that's the threshold for contentment, then church, how rich are we? If, as far as God's concerned, if we have food and clothes, we ought to be content with that. How rich are we? Now, we don't tend to think of ourselves as rich because we swim in the pool. We swim in the pool with all the other people in America who have money. But you go to a third world country, you could go to Ukraine right now, and they would love to have what we take for granted. Cambodia would love to have what we take for granted. Haiti. You take any third world country. And I remember, Jan tells me I need to quit telling the same stories over and over again, but I forget I've told them. So one of our first times in Cambodia, I asked him what was their dream home. And I've forgotten what the context was, but we're talking about contentment or something like that. And the guy described a home with, I think, two or three bedrooms, one for him and his wife and one for the kids, a hard floor, not dirt floors, and running water. He'll never have that. That was an aspiration for him. That was aspirational. His dream home. And I thought, at that time I was living in a church parsonage. It was about 50 years old. And it was well kept. It was fine. It was never a house that Jan and I would have ever picked. And we've been so spoiled that we've been blessed to build a couple of houses. We've been blessed to pick our houses. And we were living in a parsonage, and I thought I was being so gracious to live in their 50-year-old parsonage. Look at me, how wonderful I am to do that for this congregation because it was important to them. And then I'm over in Cambodia, and this guy describes my house as aspirational that he'll never have. And so I just kind of hung my head and came home with a lot more humility than I had when I left there. How rich are we if food and clothes is the Bible's threshold for contentment? All right, enough of that. You and I need to be careful that we don't allow greed to destroy our faith. We live in a culture that measures success by stuff. How much stuff do you have? And how good is your stuff? And how new is your stuff? And how fancy is your stuff? But at the end of the day, that stuff is worthless. Like I said, 100 years from now, the Devo, 100 years from now, it won't be our stuff if it's still surviving. And when Christ returns, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be smelted. Job in chapter 1, verse 21 said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart." Whatever we have here today, we're just temporary stewards of it. From the physical body to the clothes on the body to the house we live in to the car we drive to the food we have, we're temporary stewards of it. And what that means is, and this was kind of the measure of wealth that we talked about at the very beginning of the class, we as Christians need to measure wealth differently from the world, right? We can't afford to use the world's yardstick for measuring wealth. Success is, I'm sorry?
Well, I think the statement of taking
Yeah, right. Right.
They washed their laundry in the bath. They defecated in the bath. They cleaned their... I mean, if you can even start to imagine, and I've made the statement many times, there are no poor people in the United States of America.
Right, yeah. Compared to the rest of the world. Right. Jenny and I went on a 10th anniversary cruise to Puerto Vallarta, and we're driving down this road, and there's six women in the river banging their clothes against the rocks. And I asked, what's that? He goes, well, they're doing people's laundry. And then the hotel we stayed in, we were on the third floor, we can look back into the city, and we can see houses that they used old license plates for walls, wired together for walls. You don't have to go too far to find that we are stinking rich. You can go to parts of northeast Oklahoma and find that we are wealthy by many standards. Yeah, were you going to say something? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right here. Yeah. You don't have to leave the country, do you? So yeah, absolutely. We are rich by most anybody's standard. And if food and clothing is the standard for contentment, then man, we are stinking rich. So. There's a word in here at the end of the chapter that deals with wealth within the congregation. It starts in chapter 6, verse 17. And this speaks for those who have money within the congregation. 1 Timothy 6, verse 17. Command those who are rich in this pleasant world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. So this is Paul telling Timothy, as a minister to the congregation in Ephesus, hey, minister, there's some people in your congregation that need to hear this word about a proper measure of wealth. There's some people in your congregation who have an unhealthy relationship with material stuff. And what's interesting, I find the language here, and I didn't check with the other ones. The end of verse 17, in the one I'm reading from, it says, God richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. What do you have with that? Does it say enjoyment in your translation too?
Everything to enjoy.
So if I'm reading that right, what that means is I've got food and I've got clothing, which should bring contentment. That, along with everything else I have, should bring what? Joy. I not only should be content, I ought to be giddy.
Well, verse 18 tells you what you ought to do.
Exactly, yeah. And so we press on, verse 18. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. Some translations say willing to communicate. In this way, they'll lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life, make take hold of eternal life. So Paul's telling Timothy, you got some folks in your congregation with an unhealthy relationship with money, and help them retrain their brain to decide the stuff they have is for their contentment and for their joy, and part of the joy is being rich in giving. You've experienced some of that, right? There's a joy in being able to give to others. We've done that with the Mark 10 that the kids are packing, or our kids are packing bags for Mark 10 tonight, part of their LTC program. And so Debbie's got the great ministry with Kiefer and now with Glenpool. We saw that with our littlest angel, where I think we went from like 12 angels last year to 40-something this year, and people were still going, is there more? Can we do more? You see that with our Care Portal ministry, working with DHS for families who are in trouble and who are struggling to reunite and pull their families together. We see that it's a blessing. There's a certain joy in being able to use what we have to bring blessings to somebody else's life. For somebody who's the the hoarder, the I'm going to hold on to it. And that's what he says here. Verse 17, be careful not to put your hope in wealth. Have you ever known anybody who their wealth was their security blanket? And anything that they saw or perceived as a threat to that was terrifying or frustrating or infuriating to them, and they would defend their wealth to the end because that's where their security came from. That's evidently some of the problem we have in the church in Ephesus. So he's calling to have a healthy relationship with money and with material things. Why? Because greed destroys faith. We've got about 6 minutes before the bell rings, if I'm reading my clock right. Thoughts, comments? Jim? Jim, was that a hand or was it a thought? I didn't know if you were bidding or... All right, so you were telling me Larry had a hand. All right.
Well, I think that the church needs to do more teaching on wealth.
Okay, the church
needs
more...
parents then need to finish that off with their kids and teach them because, you know, the world has a completely different outlook on what we're talking about tonight. This is the opposite of what our kids are taught in school.
Right. It is absolutely an unhealthy relationship with money and wealth is pervasive. And it's not just our community. But every Christmas, there's kids whose Christmas will be destroyed if they don't get the hot item. You may have heard kids who were just devastated because mom and dad got them a cell phone, but it wasn't the newest, bestest. It was a reconditioned model or a hand-me-down from mom and dad, how am I going to show my face among my friends with this old phone or with these old shoes or with this last year's outfit? And honestly, where do they learn that? They learn it from us, right? I mean, they learn it from us. I'm not saying you and me in particular, but they learn it from the grown-ups. And I don't know. I'm certainly not immune to that, Debbie. Yes, yeah. Right.
Just like, you know, sacking the backpack. I explained that to the kids back there to help them. You know, and I told them, I said, hey, you guys want to come and help deliver?
Yes.
No, I just think by example and letting them experience those things.
Right. If all you know are your peers who are in the same income bracket as you are, then you don't get to see much of that. But as was pointed out, you don't have to go very far to find families who would love to have what we have. And you can do that through Mark 10 and the deliveries with the kids at school who need that food to carry them through the evenings and the weekends. You see that with our care portal who... There are families that are there's families. I can't tell you how many times when we were doing Care Portal in the past that families and homes have to rise to a certain level, DHS's level, for the kids to be able to come back into the house. And one of those is every child needs to have their own bed. You can't put two or three kids in a bed, no matter how big the bed is. So almost every request we had was for twin beds or for bunk beds or for cribs or for something like that. And you know, car seats. We probably none of us in here would call ourselves rich, but we probably all could go out tonight on our way home and get a car seat if that was what we needed. Not every family can say that, or a crib or something. So yeah, we need to help not only our kids but some of us to develop a healthier attitude and a healthier view of wealth. And if the standard is food and clothes and everything else is gravy, oh man, we're rich. Anybody else? Jim?
Now, you're extremely difficult.
Yeah, well, and we're all age, we can all have more stuff than we need, regardless of the age, right? I have a 3-car garage, which tells you how poor I am. I only have a 3-car garage. And somebody said, well, can you get your 3 vehicles in there? I said, heck no. I need a 5-car garage because 2 bays are full of my junk.
Tear down the old barns
and build new ones. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
This morning you met the
10-year barn and a 20-year barn?
They built another barn.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, okay. We started with this barn, and it got full, so we built the 10-year barn, built a 20-year barn. Well, Jack and I were laughing about this the other day. I've never met anybody who built a barn or built a shop and said, boy, that's way too big. Or if they built it, maybe while they were paying for it to be constructed, they said it's way too big. But once they started putting their junk in there, I've never found one that couldn't get full to brim. And how, that's a great problem to have, but it's a problem if we don't have a healthy relationship with stuff. If we don't have a healthy relationship with stuff and don't realize that we are stewards temporarily of this stuff, and that it's one thing to fluff our nest with our surplus income, but maybe that some more of that money might be better used to bless somebody else's nest rather than to continue to fluff ours. And I'm right there in the middle of that. Any other thoughts before we close for tonight? Thank you for your help. Thank you for your participation. I think we're past time for the bell to ring. So God bless you. We will break for tonight, and Lord willing, we'll come back on Sunday morning. Thank you. We're dismissed.